As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Tom Butler.
And I'm Brendan Duffy.
You're listening to the James Bond A to Z podcast.
Join us on this journey of discovery across the world of the 007 movies as we take an encyclopedic look at cinema's greatest spy films.
We'll learn about the people who made them in front of the camera and behind, from Ken Adam to Mac Zorin, with the occasional detour down a few rabbit holes. And we'll sometimes be joined by guests with unique insight into the world of Bond.
This podcast is in no way affiliated with the James Bond brand, Eon, or the Fleming Estate. We do our best to make sure the information is accurate, but sometimes we do get it wrong. If you want to correct us on something or add some more detail, email us on podcast@jamesbondatz.co.uk.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to the James Bond A to Z podcast, where W is for Wilson, Michael G. Wilson. My name is Thomas I. Butler, and joining me is to explore the life and career of the co-writer of five Bond films, producer of 15 Bond films, and the brains behind James Bond Jr. Consider him slimed. It's Mr. Brendan J. Duffy.
Oh, nice. Yes, hello.
So, Michael G. Wilson, he's an interesting one, isn't he? I think when you think about the people behind Bond, you think Cubby, you think Harry. And nowadays, I think if you ask the man on the street, they'd probably be able to name Barbara Broccoli as the producer.
Yeah, absolutely. Despite the fact he is the producer that has produced Bond films the longest, longer than all of them.
Than all of them, yeah, absolutely. Something we will we'll discuss, I guess. Yeah, he has the biggest. I mean, his shadow should loom larger than all the others. Mm-hmm. But I think by his nature, I think he's sort of happy to take a bit of a back role, a bit of a back seat. He's a bit of enigmatic in that sense.
I would absolutely agree. And, you know, it's a nice place to start if we start from his early life. It's difficult to find much about him, to be honest.
Yeah. What did you find out?
Okay, so he was born in New York, and he's the son of Dana, who was married to Lewis Wilson. He was an actor. And Lewis Wilson was the first actor to play, can you guess which major?
I know
you,
this.
You know it. We've
talked this about this. It's Batman, isn't it?
Yeah, so Michael G. Wilson is the son of Batman. So they were both actors, Dana and Lewis, and they met at drama school in New York in the early 40s. And then after Michael was born, they moved to California. So I think they split up pretty soon after that. They got a divorce. And then when he was 17, when Michael was 17, she met Cubby. And we talked about this in the Cubby episode. 6 weeks later, they got married after they first met. It was a whirlwind, wasn't it? And Cary Grant was the best man.
So when was that? Do you know? Was that sort of in the 50s?
1958, yeah.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And talking about when Michael was young, he said he wanted to be a lawyer and not be involved in the film industry in particular. He said, because I knew how insubstantial the film business was. And obviously, yeah, he'd seen what it can do to people. You know, chews you up and spits you out, I guess. So growing up, he's been with him. But in terms of having a new father figure, you know, that can always be potentially problematic, can't it? Especially at his age, he was 17. So, but they always got on, him and Cubby. He said, we were the best of friends, best friends. So, and we'll see that throughout this episode, I'm sure, how very close they got. So, yeah, I mean, that's his early life. That's as much as I could dig up. I don't know if you found anything else. Obviously, then we go on to his education, which there's slightly more, isn't there?
Yeah, there's a bit more to tell you about his education. But, yeah, I mean, you talk about that sort of father figure coming in at that sort of age of 17 where you're sort of becoming a man yourself.
Yeah,
It's quite a father figure to inherit, I think, Cubby.
Absolutely.
By all accounts.
Yeah.
And obviously this gregarious Italian background that he had. Must have been, quite a big change for young Michael G. By the way, what does the G stand for? Did you get as far as that? Oh, I think it stands for Greg.
Right. Okay.
You look it up, and I'll talk about his education.
Yeah, okay.
But yeah, I mean, just to say, I mean, he's in his 80s now, isn't he, Michael? I think he's just turned 80, hasn't he?
I think he's 81.
Yeah. So looking back at his education. Can't tell you much about his high school education, but I know that he went to a place called Harvey Mudd College to study electrical engineering in the early 1960s. And he actually received a Bachelor of Science degree in electrical engineering. So you talk about his family being in the film industry. About electrical engineering is probably about as far away from that as you could get, really.
Yeah.
So you can see here, you know, he wants to plough his own, furrow, I can't remember what which way around it is. Anyway, this place he went to, the Harvey Mudd College, it's a private college in California, and it's focused very much on science and engineering. And it was only founded in 1955. Classes then began a couple of years later in 57. And the founding year, there was only 48 students, one building and a dormitory. So Michael must have been like one of the first students through the door at this place in its early years. But as a private college, you know, he comes from a wealthy background, I guess. They sort of were able to get him in there. But some of the other people that went to Harvey Mudd include Jonathan Gay, the creator of Adobe Flash, and Michael Tapper from the band We Are Scientists.
Ah.
So, yeah, apparently it's got a very sort of rich heritage of people coming from there into software.
Right.
So later, many, many years later, in fact, 2020, he got a Lifetime Recognition Award from Harvey Mudd College. And that's sort of to honour people who go on to have a dedication to the college and also to service to society. And he was also chosen to be on the Association of Board of Governors there at Harvey Mudd as well. So after leaving there, he went to work, working in electrical engineering, I believe, but not long after that, actually switched, made a complete about face, went from studying, obviously, from his engineering industry, and he enrolled at Stanford University to study law. And he got a Juris Doctor degree from the Stanford Law School. So basically, he's a doctor of law. And the Juris Doctor, the JD, it's a graduate entry profession, a graduate entry level professional degree in law. In America, so it's the standard degree that you have to obtain to practice law in America. So yeah, that, I mean, Stanford Law is a private another private university, and that's in California, and it's considered to be one of the most prestigious law schools in the world. So quite incredible for this guy to go from electrical engineering, do a complete right turn into law. I think he sort of demonstrates this a man of, you know, great intellect.
Absolutely.
A very smart guy who can turn his mind to whatever he wants to. So that's what he did. Went to Stanford, studied law, got his JD in law.
And just an update on the middle name. It's Greg.
Mm.
Three G's. So it's Michael GGG Wilson. So, yeah, in terms of his career, what did he do next? Well, he went and worked for the government for a bit and then moved on to a firm that were in Washington, and they specialised in international law. So, again, he's really doubling down on his knowledge and using that intellect. But he had a little foray into Bond whilst he was doing this job. I don't know if you're going to cover this, but it was during Goldfinger. And he says that he said, I graduated, I came over to London. I drove out with Cubby to the airport with my mother. And he said, gee, I could really use some help with this film. It's too bad you don't have your passport. And I had it in my back pocket. So I went with him to New York and we went down to Fort Knox for 3 weeks. And that was my first taste of working in the film business. So obviously, you know, it wasn't enough to drag him away at this point. He still went on, like I said, to become a lawyer and went to Washington and joined the firm. And he went to New York with that same firm as well.
So just to take you back to Goldfinger, I actually have got a little bit on this as well.
Ah, great.
One of the jobs when he was on Goldfinger, and it was at the Fort Knox stuff that they were filming when he was there. I think it was there for about 3 weeks. One of the jobs he was asked to do was stand in for Harold Sakata. So I imagine it would be for, you know, camera tests or whatever, and while they were waiting for Harold to come from his thing. But one of the times he had forgotten to bring Oddjob's hat with him, and he'd left it in the hotel room. And so Guy Hamilton had to give him a bit of a dressing down, which apparently Guy Hamilton never let Michael forget about. Yeah, a bit of a baptism of fire there on Goldfinger.
Yeah, no wonder he went straight back to law.
Yeah.
So he stayed with that law firm for 6 years. So starting to carve out a real career for himself in the law industry until Bond comes knocking, obviously, at some point.
Yeah, I mean, 6 years is a long old time, isn't it? It's a lifetime for some people.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, very much, obviously, very established in his role there.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so let's move into the 1970s. So obviously, the Bond films are being made in the background of Michael's life with his mother, very much Dana, involved with the production side of things very heavily. She's sort of one of the unsung heroes of the Bond series, and his stepfather, Cubby, producing them. But it's not really until Man with the Golden Gun in 74, isn't it?
Yeah.
74, in which Michael is called upon by Cubby to help out with a specific task, which is the purchase of a seaplane. Now, the seaplane that they use in The Man with the Golden Gun was initially going to be something else, possibly a boat or something. They said, we need something more exciting. We need a seaplane. And obviously, they're filming in Thailand. So Michael has to lean upon Michael to use his international law skills to buy this seaplane in America and have it flown out to Thailand. Obviously, Michael's legal mind was used to cut through all the red tape and get this seaplane out to Thailand for them to use on a film set, which just sounds like a mind-mogglingly crazy sort of bit of admin that you'd have to deal with. But obviously, as we know on Man with the Golden Gun, that was the last film that Cubby and Harry made together. There was a lot of, tension between the two producing partners, mainly because of Harry's extracurricular activities, which had left him in a very precarious financial predicament, which he had to extricate himself from. And he basically ended up selling his part of the shares of Eon to MGM, or United Artists, as it was at the time. So when this whole divorce process was going on between Harry and Cubby, Michael, who is now at this stage a specialist tax lawyer, he helped to represent Cubby alongside Cubby's longtime attorney, a guy called Norman Tyer. So that was where Michael sort of starts to become really integral to the story of Bond. And so with Harry Saltzman out of the picture for the next movie, The Spy Who Loved Me in 1977, Cubby brought Michael into the fold on the Bond films to be a special assistant to the producer. And one of the first tasks Michael was given was to negotiate with the Ian Fleming estate about how they could adapt The Spy Who Loved Me. Because if you remember when we talked about Fleming, I think, or The Spy Who Loved Me, Fleming made it very clear. He stipulated that they couldn't adapt the book, but they could use the title.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a very strict sort of legal do's and don'ts on how they adapt that story, because that story was a very, very controversial book when it was published. That was Michael's role there. And then when on The Spy Who Loved Me, this is where we also see Michael stepping in and using his creative mind on the movies as well. So he becomes a key advisor on the films from this point onwards, becomes very involved. And it's Michael who, flicking through a magazine, a Playboy magazine, finds the Canadian Club advert, which has the man jumping off the mountain, that inspires the opening sequence. So you can see there, you know, Michael's creative mind is turning, and it's having a direct impact on the films. And, you know, as we say, it's one of the greatest Bond moments of all time.
Yeah.
So then from that point, he was promoted to executive producer on Moonraker. And again, using his mind and his knowledge, he played a very key part in the pre-title sequence on Moonraker as well. He found BJ Wirth, the skydiving expert that would become one of the most integral stunt people on Bond. And then working the sequence out with John Glenn. You know, it's the scene where they jump out the plane and they have to fight over a parachute with Jaws. That was all Michael G. Wilson's idea. They worked the sequence out with John Glenn. They found the parachutist. And then he was also very importantly helped to find the lightweight plastic camera lenses needed to be able to shoot that free fall sequence. And interestingly, I also found out that Michael helped to shoot some underwater footage. Apparently, he's a very good underwater swimmer. He helped to shoot some underwater footage for The Spy Who Loved Me for a scene where I think there's an anaconda. I think it's possibly in Drax's lair, and there's like a snake, isn't there? But there was some underwater footage there that Michael shot, but that didn't make it into the film. But that takes us up to 1979. And it's really then in the 80s where he really steps up.
Ah, he definitely does. He puts the camera down, you know, and then goes and picks the pen up. And this is where we see him collaborating with Richard Maybaum. Starting in for the 1981 film For Your Eyes Only. And they had, judging by what I've read, they seem to have a really good working relationship. You had sort of the old school methods of Richard Maybaum and then the more modern approach from Michael G. Wilson. Richard Maybaum said, "When we start out, we do a very full treatment, sometimes 50 or 60 pages long. I've done many films with Cubby and he likes to know beforehand what it's going to be." He said, "Sometimes Michael will write the first draft or I will write the first draft and we give it to the other fellow and argue about it. There's an awful lot of arguing that goes on. But you know what they say, if collaborators don't argue, then there's one collaborator too many." So, yeah, it seemed like Maybaum was definitely stuck in his ways. And John Glenn said that Maybaum wrote his stuff in longhand and then typed it up on the typewriter. But Wilson was using a word processor, even at this point. Right. So they definitely had different methods, which meant when it came to a rewrite, Richard Maybaum was really resistant about sort of cutting scenes and stuff. Whereas obviously Michael G. Wilson is a bit more flexible to that sort of thing. But he talked about his approach on writing for Your Eyes Only. And Michael said, "I don't like the use of gadgets. We've seen too many of them. There's always a cheat. Usually you set up a gadget that can only be used in a very unique situation that wouldn't apply generally. What I like best is when you set up a situation that the gadget is perfect for and Bond really needs it. Just as he takes it out of his pocket, it's knocked from his hand and plummets 9 stories down to the ground. Now what's Bond going to do? That's the fun." And if you remember back to our For Your Eyes Only, this one, they really went back to the Fleming novels and wanted to create that classic Bond and took a lot from Russia With Love. Is that the one they used as reference? That was the major one?
Yeah, I think they always sort of, that's the one they always say.
The blueprint, wasn't it?
Want to get it back to that style, yeah.
Yeah. And then obviously moving forward, Octopussy in 1983, that kind of goes out the window. And Michael G. Wilson said about this, he said, "The first 3 Bond films were certainly classics of the cinema, and I have no qualms about being compared to these pictures. I want to see Octopussy listed in that league. Octopussy is a spectacle, it's basically still a fantasy product, but more realistic." That's got to be a promotional quote because, yeah. But when we get to A View to a Kill in 1985, he steps up again. And so he's still co-writing with Richard Maybaum, but he's promoted from executive producer to co-producer with Cubby on this one. So this is his entry into being that he is top dog essentially by this point. Which is strange, isn't it? Because I still don't think of him in the same league as Cubby. And yet, 1985, that's nearly 40 years ago.
Yeah.
When is it? What year is it now? It's 38 years ago, yeah. Yeah, which by this point, Cubby was doing it for 23.
Yeah.
So, yeah, crazy. In terms of writing this one, he said, for all practical purposes, we've been out of material for the past 5 films. We will bring in the occasional Fleming element from the books, which haven't been used in the films, but that's not much help when you get down to basic plotting. And Maybaum, this is again where he sings these praises of working with Michael. He said Michael is very receptive. He's the only man I've actually worked with on the Bonds. Other writers have come on before or after me, but never with me until Michael. He has lots of ideas and we like each other, which always helps. So I guess it was more of a harmonious period during the 80s, isn't it? Regardless of what the end results are, you know, there seemed to be more stability across these films in the 80s. You've got John Glenn directing every film, same writing team.
Yeah. Roger.
Roger.
To a point.
Yeah, to a point.
And I think actually when you look at those first 3 Michael G. Wilson penned films, so For Your Eyes Only, Octopussy, A View to a Kill, something that unites them is a move towards that sort of 5 minutes into the future mentality, isn't it? It's technology. Mm-hmm. You've got the ATAC in For Your Eyes Only. You've got the whatever the plot of Octopussy was, but like it's a more technology based situation. And then also with View to a Kill, you've got the whole Silicon Valley thing. You can see that they're thinking about technology and how it affects the world and how we're moving away from this sort of classic Cold War type tale.
Yeah, absolutely. So that meant moving to Living Daylights, they had a new problem to deal with. Like you said, Roger's that stability once he's gone. And they don't know who's coming in right until the last minute, as we've covered before. And he says that when they wrote it, you know, they didn't know who was going to take on Bond. He said the script was finished and we were well into pre-production before Dalton was cast. So Tim played Bond as he saw it in our script. This time, having seen his ideas, there was no doubt about it. The films are influenced by the way the actor plays Bond. We saw that Tim has a certain way of doing things. And that shows when you watch The Living Daylights, there's scenes that Roger, there are Roger-themed, Roger-flavoured scenes in Living Daylights for sure. He offered some advice as well when Dalton took the role, because obviously it was such a late stage and it was all very rushed through. So he said that Dalton would need to promote the film and the publicity is going to be immense. So he tried to prepare him for what was coming. And then as we move to the last film of the 80s, we have an issue, because the initial outline of License to Kill, Michael G. Wilson and Richard Maybaum came up with, but before they could really get going and developing that script, the Writers Guild of America went on strike, and that meant Richard Maybaum was unable to continue. So Wilson, he actually finished it on his own, so there's largely a lot of Michael G. Wilson stuff in this one. And he has compared this to Akira Kurosawa's Yojimbo. I think we talked about that on the License to Kill episode, which was then remade a Fistful of Dollars. So he said he's used those themes very much so in License to Kill, and that's what helped him finish it. And
that's taking the bad guys to turn them against each other and take themselves down, isn't it? That's core theme of Yojimbo.
Yeah. So yeah, that's his 80s. Obviously, he's really established himself throughout that. But moving into the 90s, does he put the pen down? What happens after that?
Well, I mean, the 90s is really where Michael G. Wilson comes to the fore of Bond. I mean, the start of the decade is very the company Eon, the Bond franchise is in a really, really sticky situation legally, which we've covered at length before. But basically, after License to Kill happened, Michael G. Wilson started to work on a plot outline for Bond 17, and he was working with this newcomer writer, Alphonse Ruggiero. Basically, they knew, or it felt like at the time, they were moving away. They were going to leave John Glenn, Richard Maybaum behind. They were moving into the 90s. They needed to do something new. So they brought this guy, Alphonse Ruggiero, and they started working on it. But unfortunately, due to legal actions, I think everything was put on hold. You can go back and see our sort of GoldenEye episode for more detail on what was going on there. But this guy, Alphonse, he had worked on Miami Vice and a show called Wise Guy. So you can sort of see this sort of slightly different influence on Bond coming in. And there was actually a poster advertising Bond 17 on display at Cannes Film Festival in 1990. Thanks to Mark Edlitz's great book, The Lost Adventures of James Bond, there's quite a lot of information out there about this treatment that Michael G. Wilson did with Alphonse Ruggiero. And Ruggiero does an interview with Mark, and he said, "We started our meeting and Michael couldn't have been nicer or more giving as a partner. I was a little shocked at that. I thought he might be a little dictatorial because this is his and his family's baby and he's done so many of them. But instead, he was very collaborative and supportive. Michael is great. He had a million ideas. He was fun to be in a room with and talk to. He's a sophisticated guy who has lived with the life of James Bond for many years. And when we ended up doing the script, we wrote it at his house." And this is a lovely little insight, a little bit detail about the process they would do. He says he would make a loaf of bread every morning. We would talk as he made the bread. Then he would put it in the oven, and later we would use the bread for sandwiches for lunch. It was great. It was very homey. He lived out in Malibu. It was inland, so there was no one around. And Michael is a very good hiker, so we would hike and we would talk. We would make his bread. He has also one of the best photography collections in the world, which we'll talk about later. But I think what you can sort of can grasp from that is that attitude. He hasn't come from a film world, right? Mm-hmm. He's come from the real world. He doesn't exist in this Hollywood bubble. And the only Hollywood person he really knows is Cubby. And Cubby also has, from my understanding, you know, like this homely way of doing things, mm-hmm. very down to earth, very people person. So I think that image of working with Michael on this script is just, it sounds idyllic, really. So after they finish their work on Bond 17, Dalton's third Bond movie, a couple of writers called William Davies and William Osborne were then hired to turn that into a screenplay. And that you can read about that online as well. But and then there was another Bond treatment also commissioned at this time. And this was Reunion with Death by Richard Smith. And again, you can read all about that in Mark Edlitz's excellent book. But you're basically legal issues between United Artists, MGM, Danjack delayed the production on Bond 17. It took until December 1992, sort of nearly 3 years after the last Bond film, that the rights were settled and the lawsuits were settled. And so MGM, who are now being run by this bank, basically Credit Lyonnais, they then began to develop Bond 17 with Danjack and Eon in 1993. So 4 years later from the last Bond film. So, but in between this fallow period between License to Kill and GoldenEye, Michael G. Wilson kept the Bond name alive by spearheading the creation of James Bond Jr., the one and only animated spin-off of James Bond. Bond. James Bond Jr. No one can stop him, but scum always tries. Young Bond cuts through each web of spies. He learned the game from his Uncle James. Now he's laughing, Brendan.
Yeah. Great.
Did you ever watch this when it was on air?
No, I didn't.
No.
Did you?
No, I was sort of aware of it. It was sort of around in the ether at the time. But I never really... I think I watched a few episodes at the time, but it was just never on when I was watching TV. So, but yeah, James Bond Jr. was created... And this is an animated spin-off. It aired on US television from September 1991. There were 65 episodes made, 25 minutes each in length.
Wow.
And with Michael G. Michael G. Wilson worked with producer Andy Haywood, writer and producer Robbie London, and they together wrote the show Bible. And Robbie London, again, talking to Mark Edlitz in his book, said that Michael G. Wilson said Michael turned out to be a terrific boss and collaborator. I really enjoyed working with him and respected him creatively. He had written some of the Bond movies, so he brought a real writer's sensibility to the table. The initial meeting involved relating what was important to him in terms of protecting and serving the franchise and what his general expectations and concerns were. I was reasonably knowledgeable about Bond and all its famous signatures, but I recall Michael going over a lot of that with me. It was certainly fun to hear it from the source. I felt I had bonded creatively with Michael. I remember he took me out on a celebratory rap lunch after the completion of the Bible, and he introduced me to the legendary Cubby Broccoli, the father of the James Bond movie franchise. So they did all this work, 65 episodes. I think it was the people behind the Ninja Turtles cartoon that perhaps they turned to, and they were the creative people that went on to do it. But it just never really gelled. I mean, it's quite hard to take the idea of Bond and package it as a kid's show.
Yeah.
A lot of the things that you think about Bond, the violence, the cars, the drinking, you can't have all this,
no.
The sex, the sadism, all this stuff. It doesn't work in a teen setting. So you can sort of, unsurprisingly, it didn't continue. What is a surprise is that they've never put it on streaming.
Yeah.
Because I think that's something they could put on Amazon, right? Now.
Definitely.
You know,
yeah.
People would watch it. I'm sure they would. So in back to Bond itself, May 1993, MGM announced Bond 17 was back in the works to be produced and based on a screenplay by Michael France. But sadly, with Cubby Broccoli's health deteriorating, Barbara Broccoli at the time said that her father was taking a bit of a backseat in the film's production. And so Barbara Broccoli and Michael J. Wilson took over the lead roles in production while Cubby oversaw the production as a consulting producer credited as presenter of GoldenEye. And sadly, Cubby died 7 months after the release of GoldenEye. But Pierce Brosnan was the man who was brought in. They had him lined up because of the situation they'd had with Timothy Dalton previously. See our Brosnan episodes for more detail on that. But Michael G. Wilson, he saw that GoldenEye, one of the things that he sort of stipulated was that the movie needed to be post-Cold War. And also because of his brain and his mind, he was also key to putting the idea of the internet within that movie. And he actually had to explain to Jeffrey Kane what the internet was. Very smart guy. And talking about the pressures of GoldenEye at the time, Michael G. Wilson said, "We have a successful series, and of course you're always on the line every picture. The next picture we do will be on the line again. You're never not on the line. You can't ever relax. You can't ever sit back. This picture is probably more important for the studio than it is for us in the sense of financial impact it will have." Then Cubby died in 96. And paying tribute to him, Michael said, "In our office, we sat across from each other. He was my mentor and my dearest friend." Then they talked about Bond coming back. They said that they vowed to continue the series. "Barbara and myself had to view our working life after his death as a new beginning. We have inherited what legions of fans around the world think of as something of a holy grail. We also have the pressure that goes with it. Cubby never cut back on budgets, skimped on the sets or first-class action sequences. He always had high production values. Barbara and I have pledged to produce the films in the same way."
I mean, that's absolutely huge pressure for them both. But they,
unbelievable,
But they've had such a great mentor.
Yeah. But at this stage, I mean, after GoldenEye, you see Michael stepping away from any sort of writing duties.
Mm.
But he obviously playing a key part into finding out what Bond is, figuring out who Bond is. And this is where we talk about them getting the writers together to figure out a Bond Bible, perhaps inspired by the Bible that they wrote for the James Bond Jr. and they went on to produce obviously all the 90s Bond films together. And we've covered these films at length. So just as a potted history, you know, Tomorrow Never Dies was fraught with difficulties. They faced another legal battle with Kevin McClory at the time when he was trying to get things off the ground with Sony. So that was something that Michael and Barbara dealt with together. On The World Is Not Enough, they introduce Robert Purvis and Wade. It's Neil Purvis and Robert Wade. And at the time, Michael talked about not missing out on the writing. He says, "When you're a producer supervising writers, you get your oar in the water. There's enough going on to satisfy that." And one of the things that Michael introduced on that film, on The World Is Not Enough, was the chainsaw helicopters. That was a Michael G. Wilson idea that went into the movie.
Hmm.
Then we've got Die Another Day. and talking about working with Michael, the MGM exec at the time, Chris McGurk, said Michael was very cerebral, very thoughtful, very wedded to the tradition of the Bond movies. He comes at things from a more intellectual standpoint, saying that Michael can be the voice of reason. So that's how he sort of, he says that Barbara is very passionate, Michael's very intellectual, and that's the sort of the yin and yang of them, yeah. The two of them. And it's at this stage on Die Another Day that we have Michael's son Greg being brought into the fold. And so more on Greg in a minute. And on Die Another Day, Greg Wilson would take notes at story meetings and then adding his own ideas where appropriate. And on Die Another Day, one of the big important decisions was Lee Tamahori. Barbara and Michael backed him all the way. He was the director they wanted. MGM didn't want him, but they backed their man. For better or for worse, and later found themselves distancing themselves from the whole decision. Talking about the challenge after Die Another Day, they said, we actually had to sit down and write the next film, and it became abundantly clear that you had nowhere to go without being frankly science fiction. And that being the case, it became harder and harder to come up with a plot and situations in that vein. So that takes us up to 2002, and yeah. But before we dive into the next sort of big Bond era, there's something you can't talk about Michael G. Wilson without mentioning, and that's his cameos.
Coffee? Medium sweet. Two, medium sweet.
Thanks for listening. We hope you're enjoying the James Bond A to Z podcast. Remember, if you want to support the show, we have a coffee page at ko-fi.com/JamesBondA-Z, where you can buy us a coffee for just £3 or for £3 a month. Thanks for listening. Back to the show.
Is that all it does?
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. So he has made lots of cameos, and speaking, both speaking and non-speaking, both credited and uncredited. His first, do you know what his first was?
Right, let me think. It's going to be on, no, I don't know. Fiores Only, maybe?
Goldfinger.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
As a soldier in the Fort Knox scene.
Oh, can you see him?
Sort of. It's right. Quite dubious, but there's a video on YouTube that compiles them all together. It's worth having a look. But I mean, it stands to reason. He was there. We know he was there. So, but he has made a cameo appearance in every Bond film since 1977.
Wow.
Which means he's second in appearances to Desmond Llewellyn in the Bond films. Here's a list of them. And it's a really, I think it was the last episode or the one before, little Easter eggs that Bond fans can spot. What were we talking about on the previous episode?
We were talking about vodka martinis. We were also talking about Universal Export.
That's
so
it.
It has no impact on if you don't know.
Absolutely.
There,
but, and this is another one of those. It's great. And it's nice to see him pop up when you're not expecting it. So, yeah, he's at the Pyramid Show in The Spy Who Loved Me in the audience.
Right.
He is in Moonraker. He's in there twice. He's a tourist in Venice on the bridge in the background.
Right.
It's a hard one to spot that. And he's also a NASA technician. He's a priest at a Greek wedding in For Your Eyes Only.
Yeah, that was the one I was thinking of, because he's got like the priest,
yes,
smock on, hasn't he?
Yeah. He's a member of the Soviet Security Council and a tourist on a riverboat in India in Octopussy. In A View to a Kill, he's just a voice. He's a voice when Bond enters the San Francisco City Hall.
Okay.
Living Daylights, he is an audience member at the Vienna Opera House. He's quite visible in that one.
Yes. Is he sat with his wife in that one?
Oh, I'm not sure.
I think his wife's in that scene as well.
Ah.
Yeah.
License to Kill, he's a DEA agent in the pre-title sequence.
Right.
And he has a line, if they hurry, they might be able to grab the bastard.
Right.
So GoldenEye, he's the hand of an operative that is seen grabbing Chuck Farrell's ID.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
and he's a member of the Russian Security Council.
He's round the table, isn't he? Yeah. Yes, yeah.
Tomorrow Never Dies, he's on the video conference with Carver, and that's where he delivers the line, consider him slimed.
Slimed, yeah.
Yeah. He works in the casino in Baku in The World Is Not Enough.
Right.
He is a tourist in Havana in Die Another Day, but he's also credited in this as General Chandler. So he's...
Yes, because in the Die Another Day, at the end scene with Michael Madsen.
Yeah.
He's in one of those generals in that room, isn't he? Yeah.
Casino Royale, another very prominent one. You can probably remember this one.
Go on.
So he's the chief of police, if you remember, where they're sat outside.
Yes.
Yeah.
With Mathis. Yeah.
Quantum of Solace is a man reading a newspaper in the hotel lobby.
Oh. Okay.
He's quite visible in that one. Skyfall, he is in a deleted scene at the funeral. He's a mourner. Spectre, again, very visible. He's having a conversation with C.
Right.
And in No Time to Die... Any guesses? Do you remember where he is?
Yeah, I know this one. He's at Blofeld's birthday party, isn't he, in Cuba? Yeah.
So he's clearly a Spectre agent, isn't he? He's been in all these. He's an undercover agent, isn't he?
He's either that, or he's Stan Lee. He's the Watcher, the Bond world.
Yeah. But you know, it's great to spot him. It's always nice to see. Like I said, there's a YouTube video with them all compiled, but I think it's much more fun to just watch the film and then when he pops up, you can see him.
You've got a good drinking game, isn't it? If he pops up, have a shot.
Yeah.
So into the Craig era. Now, after Die Another Day, obviously for one reason and many, many others, it was time for a reboot. With Sony behind the films, Michael G. Wilson knew at the time with Barbara that it was clear they needed to go back to basics. And obviously he's there drawing on his experiences that he's had on the past. You know, he went from Moonraker to For Your Eyes Only. He knew it was time to pump the brakes, to go back to the books. And that's what they did. Michael and Richard Maybaum had explored the idea of doing a young James Bond, or an early career James Bond, in 1986 while they were developing The Living Daylights. But Cubby at the time nixed the idea. He said no one wants to see Bond
as an amateur or something.
As an amateur. He's got to be like fully fledged. But no, they stuck to their guns. They knew it was Casino Royale. They'd recently got the rights back to the book. Casino Royale it was going to be. And at this stage, Pierce Brosnan had priced himself out of the movies, basically. He was looking for more and more money, and Casino Royale just lent itself to a fresh start for Bond. So they needed to go and look for another Bond actor. Now, Daniel Craig was reportedly Barbara's choice right from the start. But Michael admits that they looked at a lot of people, and I'm sure that's Michael just doing his due diligence, right? Making sure, have we seen everyone? Don't let's just go for the right person. So they looked at a lot of other people while they were working on the script, because if you remember, they had Daniel, but Daniel wasn't prepared to sign on until he saw the script.
Yeah.
So while they were working on the script to make sure it met his approval, they saw lots and lots of other different actors. But Daniel Craig ended up winning the gig, and Michael and Barbara become the producers that we know today. And they make 5 James Bond films with Daniel Craig. And so by 2015, Michael had been working on the Bond films longer than Cubby had. So at this stage, Michael's been working on the Bond films longer, by seven years more than Cubby ever did do, which is quite incredible, really. And so at this point, I mean, I don't really want to go over the history of Casino Royale, Quantum of Solace, Skyfall, Spectre, No Time to Die. It's all very well documented. And also because it's so close in history, it's hard to really pick out which bits are Michael and which bits are Barbara and who's done what and who's done this. I think the further away from time we get, these things will become clear. But what in 2015, reflecting on working on the Bond films for so many years, Barbara said, and this came from AJ Chowdhury's book, Some Kind of Hero. Barbara said, Michael had many careers before the film one. He has an engineering background. He has a scientific background, and he's also good. So he's good on construction, on making things work. Michael has a tremendous amount of knowledge. He's a Renaissance man. He has the brains of a scientist and the heart of an artist. Which I think is a great great quote there. And Michael himself, talking about Bond, he said, writing and producing Bond films, I'm so thankful. How many other people have this chance? The big thing you get out of it is that for a rather small contribution to society, we have a huge public awareness and interest, and that's rather odd. There are lots of people, doctors, lawyers, research scientists, that have absolutely no recognition in life, yet are doing so much that is really important. Here we are doing something that's a matter of giving people a great experience for a couple of hours in life, and we take on tremendous media interest. So how can anyone in my position complain? And in 2021, at the No Time to Die premiere, Barbara Broccoli paid tribute to her stepbrother, Michael G. Wilson. And as we played in, I can't remember which episode it was, but I played the clip from that premiere. But she sort of hinted that it might be his last Bond film. Mm-hmm. That was the intimation. She was thanked her brother for working on these films for so many years, being a great producing partner. It felt like possibly the end of an era. But you know, he's still working on the Bond films, as far as we know. In an interview in 2022 with Variety, they're talking very much about the future of Bond and what was going to happen next. And in that interview, it says that Michael himself has even written a TV show that him and Barbara are trying to set up somewhere. So he's still, you know, he's still being creative at this age, still like very much involved with Bond at this stage. What will happen with Bond 26? I don't know. Yeah. I think he's been involved with this reality TV show as well, which I imagine is keeping him busy. And he was very, very present at the rest of the 60 years of Bond events. In fact, I interviewed him at the Christie's junket, and you know, he's very much still involved. So yeah. Who knows what the future holds? But beyond Bond, what else do we know about Michael, like what his interests and stuff are?
Well, they've got other producing credits. So along with Barbara, they have produced The Rhythm Section. I think we previously spoke about that. It was quite a big flop, quite a disappointment for them. But he's also executive produced independent films as well. The Silent Storm, Nancy and Radiator. Have you seen any of these?
No.
He executive produced Film Stars Don't Die in Liverpool, which is, of course, the biographical Gloria Graham film, which is directed by Paul McGuigan and produced by Barbara. And obviously, along with Barbara, he has a love of the stage as well. So they were involved in producing Chitty Chitty Bang Bang and Chariots of Fire in the West End, Once... Strangers on a Train, Love Letters, Othello. So yeah, that's clearly one of the passions of him as well. But most of all, it's got to be the photography. Did you know about this?
Yes. Yeah, I understand he has one of the biggest collections in the world.
Absolutely.
Or like one of the most prestigious collections.
Yeah, so he's an expert on 19th century photography. And he said, "My love of photography stretches all the way back to childhood. My father was a keen photographer, and wherever he went, he would invariably carry the suitcase that contained a mini and larger. He would set up in a bathroom and print his negatives. As a child, I was fascinated by the process and took up photography as a teen, which has remained a constant source of pleasure throughout my life." So yeah, in the 1970s, he began to collect photographs. At this point, he was already collecting antique books, manuscripts, and also books and pamphlets that were printed in Europe before 1501. So, you know, he was really into that. But he was talking to his wife and an old college friend. And his old college friend was married to someone called Weston Naif, who was a curator of prints and photographs at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. So that sort of inspired him to start transfer his collecting to photographs. So he's already collecting things, but he moved it across to photographs. And when he started, it was at a time where it wasn't really the in thing. It wasn't, you know, nobody was doing it. Galleries weren't really showing photographs at this time, I guess due to snobbery, I assume, at this point. And auction houses were just starting to have them as well. And it was a London auction that he actually bought his first batch of 19th century prints. And I mean, his collection spans the entire history of photography, and it's more often than not, it's out on loan to different galleries. He works very closely with the Tate. So along with his wife, Jane, he founded the Wilson Center for Photography. And that is a facility that researches the history, aesthetics, and the preservation of photographs. So yeah, this is a major passion of his. And he actually did a special 007 edition product of with Leica. He teamed up with Leica. And they set of 25 images. And he curated this. And so there were four people who each had a Leica camera to take photos while they were making No Time to Die. So yeah, Daniel Craig had one. Greg Williams, who of course, he wrote the book. He did the...
Die Another Day onwards, didn't he?
Yeah, he's done the Bond on set. That's it, isn't it? That's what it's called.
Yeah.
Nicola Dove and himself. So they're on the Leica website. There's some really good photos, actually. And each one's got a different flavour. And he said, when curating the portfolio, often opted for black and white images in the traditional style. Leica cameras and lenses produce excellent results in this medium. Each photographer not only brought their unique vision to the project, but also a personal relationship to the subject. And he said that Daniel Craig's got a very particular eye. And he said he's taken some wonderful behind the scenes shots focused on the people who help us bring Bond to life. He said, Greg Williams is, of course, a world-renowned photographer who has worked with us on Bond for many years. Nicola Dove is on set full-time to document the making of the film. She's forever watching those special moments. And he said, I just snap at anything that moves. very, very humble there, because his photos are very good as well. So he's also a fellow of the Science Museum in London. He's a trustee for the Carnegie Institution for Science, Harvey Mudd College, and Santa Barbara Museum of Art. In 2010, he was given the Royal Photographic Society's Award for Outstanding Service to Photography, and that goes along with an honorary fellowship of the society as well. Along with Barbara, they are the founders of the London Screen Academy. 2014, along with Barbara, they were given the Producers Guild of America, the David O. Selznick Achievement Award in Theatrical Motion Pictures. 2013, they got the BAFTA Award for Outstanding British Film for Skyfall. 2008, they were appointed Officers of the Order of the British Empire, so OBE. And then in 2022, they were awarded CBEs, which is Commander of the Order of the British Empire.
So, I mean, that really wraps up the Michael's involvement in Bond, but... it's worth talking about the next generation of Wilsons, because Michael isn't the last one working on Bond. like you said, he's married to his wife Jane, and they've got two sons. The older brother is David G. Wilson. I think the G stands for Greg. And he, up until 2017, was the head of creative and business affairs for Eon Screenwriters Workshop, and as well as the vice president of global business strategy for Eon. But he left the company to work on, he's got like a video game venture that he works with, and it's like creating experiences in augmented reality and virtual reality and stuff. But David, he started out as a screenwriter and assistant producer, and he worked as an assistant director on lots of Japanese films in Tokyo, lots of sort of small low budget films. And then on Bond, he got credits as an assistant, additional assistant director on GoldenEye, a computer network administrator on Tomorrow Never Dies, a systems administrator on The World Is Not Enough, and he worked on product placement for Die Another Day. He has an assistant producer credit on Casino Royale and also a script editor credit on Quantum of Solace. But like I said, he's very much been involved with the video games as well, and was the executive producer on GoldenEye 007, GoldenEye Reloaded, Bloodstone, and also 007 Legends. But after Casino Royale and his experience with the video games, he sort of decided to move out on his own, and he's now a venture capital angel investor, a startup mentor, and the CEO of a platform called the Shared Experience Art Machine. So that's David Wilson. But Greg Wilson is the one that seems to be being groomed for big things at Eon. And as we mentioned, Greg was first involved on Die Another Day, where he was credited as a development executive. And talking about his time on Bond, he said, "I joined Eon officially just before Quantum of Solace. I was freelancing for my first couple of Bond films before I realised that this is something that I definitely wanted to do. It's been an amazing thing to be part of. I like working with my family. I don't know if that's for everybody, though. At first, it seemed like the mafia. Once you join, you can never leave. But they really are wonderful people to work for, and Bond is the thing that demands most of our time and resources. But it's nice to work on different projects in between." So on Bond, he's had some sound design credits. He's also had followed in his father's footsteps and had some cameos as well. He's in the bar, the Turkish bar in Skyfall with the Scorpion. And he's also in the scene where M and C meet Inspector as well. And then on Casino Royale, Greg was assistant editor. So you can see there he's sort of finding his feet in the film industry, very much like Barbara did when she joined Eon. She did lots of different roles in publicity and, you know, assistant producing, all that sort of stuff. So then Greg went on to be assistant producer on Quantum of Solace, associate producer on Skyfall, Spectre and No Time to Die. And he's also associate producer on Film Stars Don't Die in Liverpool, and then exec producer on The Rhythm Section. And talking about his position as an associate producer, he said the main function as a regular producer is to solve problems, and technically the producer will raise the financing, supervise the production, approve the key decisions, and then make sure the film's completed and has distribution. But I'm doing a different sort of role to all those things. Mine is more about trying to always make sure the movie is better by trying to anticipate future problems and guessing what's going to be an issue. And so it's primarily about problem solving and troubleshooting. And a lot of my time is spent having one-on-one conversations with heads of departments, visiting them, getting them to trust me as someone they can confide in. And he's becoming more and more involved in public events. And like even just over the last couple of years, he appeared on the official No Time to Die podcast doing interviews about the production of the film. And I've personally met Greg a few times now. When I went to the set of Spectre to do a second unit set visit, I met Greg then. He was one of the people that showed me round. He was very much hands-on there. I interviewed him. He was lovely. He's quite a young guy, actually, I'd say. I don't know how old he is. He's probably mid-40s, but very charming, very, very friendly. And then I met him again at the Christie's auction when I interviewed Michael G. Wilson. It was him and Greg together and they interviewed, and they were very good partnership, really. Greg's very sort of, he's very media trained, very friendly. and then at the Bond 60 years of Bond event at the BFI, he was one of the stage sort of talking heads as well. So you can see he's more and more being put in the public eye as a figurehead for Bond, which with Michael G. Wilson being 80 now, it makes sense, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Because Barbara, what's she? She's 60s herself.
Yeah.
So I think you get the sense that Barbara probably still has a few more movies in her yet, whereas Michael perhaps is probably ready to sort of step back a little bit from it, and Greg is probably the man to do it.
Yeah, feels sort of like where they're at in the mid-80s, doesn't it?
Yeah, very much so, very much so. So, I mean, taking it back to right what we were saying right at the start, Michael, he's been on the Bond films longer than anyone else now, any of the other producers on the films.
Yeah.
But he is a bit of an enigma. What do you think after this episode, what do you think you've learned about Michael?
Well, he's an intelligent man, and that intelligence has meant that he can keep the franchise going to this day.
Yeah, I think something I've learned as well is that it's not about just about keeping the franchise going. It's about keeping it on an even keel.
Mm.
And I think that's something that perhaps he has been an instrumental part of. Not to say that Barbara doesn't as well.
Yeah.
But he has this sort of logic, sort of business mind that means he can make sort of big decisions. But like what was that quote from Barbara? He's got the mind of a... The brains of a scientist and the heart of an artist. I think that just sort of sums it up really nicely, doesn't it?
Yeah.
He's got the brains to figure a lot of this stuff out, problem solve, make the big decisions, and also, you know, make bold decisions as well.
I mean, the Die Another Day, post Die Another Day, ruthless. Needed to be done.
Yeah.
Really, for the continuation of the franchise.
Yeah, and also you look at GoldenEye as well. I mean, that's obviously one that we are huge fans of.
Mm.
And yeah, Cubby was involved, but this was the one where they had to take over the reins and make a lot of interesting decisions, right?
Yeah.
They could have followed the path of License to Kill and gone gritty and done that, but they made the decision at that stage to go and make the greatest Bond film of all time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also something as well that I know that, like, you know, some people aren't a lot of people aren't that thrilled by, but if we talk about No Time to Die and that decision to kill Bond at the end,
yeah,
when you actually think about it, it's actually a really bold artistic and commercial decision to make.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
if you think about a franchise like Bond that's been going for so many years and makes so much money and has so many people relying on it, actually to kill your character, whether you think that's a good idea or not,
yeah,
is really, really, really bold.
Yeah.
And I think it takes someone with vision, producers with vision, to be able to say, you know what, Marvel, you know, they kill characters and bring them back all the time. But for Bond to do it at the end of a movie where, yeah, Bond cannot come back from, I don't know. I feel like that's a bold decision for them. And, you know, Michael and Barbara, whether you like that decision or not, it's a unique one that they made.
It is. Maybe it is Michael's. I mean, if it is, and it does seem like it could be his last, what a way to sort of tie a ribbon on his tenure.
Exactly. Yeah. And clear the slates for whatever comes next.
Exactly.
I think there's no better way of clearing the slate, is there, than making that decision. So if that is the case, I mean, it could, in 10 years, 20 years, when they look back on it, you could say that was his crowning moment. But we don't know.
No,
we don't know. It's just speculation, isn't it? Anything else to say about Michael?
Not really. Not really. No. I just think he's underappreciated.
Absolutely. And just this idea that he's written a TV show. And, you know, he's still like, you know, he's still got that fire to create and to do interesting things. I just wish him well for the future, I guess. If he does step down from Bond, then, you know, he's earned the time off now, I think.
Absolutely. He can focus on his photograph collection.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed. Well, let's wrap things up there then. So that's been our episode of Michael G. Wilson. That means that there are only a couple more episodes left to come. We'll be doing You Only Live Twice, probably as our next episode, and then our X, Y, and Z episode. And then we may just do a little wrap-up episode after that as well. But yeah, thank you for listening to this. I hope you've enjoyed this. It's a slightly different from what we usually do, but this is the last of the producers that we've done. We've done Cubby.
Yeah.
We've done Harry. We've done Barbara. Now we've done Michael. So I guess if... that'll be the last one for a while on the producers. But if you have anything you want to let us know, you can email the show at podcast@jamesbond.co.uk, or you can find us on social media. Where, Brennan?
At James Bond A to Z on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter.
So if you have anything that you want us to ask us for our final ever episodes, then please email it over sooner rather than later. Anything you want to add, any audio clips you want to send us, anything that you want to contribute will be gratefully received. And so on that note, it just remains for me to say that the James Bond A to Z podcast will return next week.
Ciao.
The James Bond A to Z podcast is hosted and produced by Tom Butler and Brendan Duffy, with music by Tom Ingemels and artwork by Helene Dolly. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please like and subscribe, and leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
He's landing at Cray Key. Advise Key West Drug Enforcement.
Roger, sir. AWACS to Key West. Key West Drug Enforcement, please come in.
If they hurry, they just might be able to grab the bastard.
Mr. Wallace, call the president. Tell him if he doesn't sign the bill lowering the cable rates, we'll release the video of him with a cheerleader in the Chicago motel room.
Inspired, sir.
And after he signs the bill, release the tape anyway.
Consider him slimed.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.